The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning, and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We're located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, but this morning we are as close to you as your home. We are a Unitarian Universalist congregation dedicated to nurturing the spirit and transforming the world. I'm Preston Lutweiler, treasurer of our Board of Trustees, and I want to personally welcome you this morning. Wherever you are on your life journey, wherever you are on your spiritual journey, whomever you love, whatever your gender identity or expression, we welcome you into our ever-expanding circle of compassion and caring. If you are visiting us today, you will notice in the Zoom chat a link to our virtual visitor card. This is a way for you to connect with us and us with you. So please fill it out anytime during the service. Today, the Reverend Aidson Wright Riggins III will preach to us on holding fast to our dreams. Our Soul Matters theme for the month of January is imagination. In our imagination, in our dreams, let us remember our seven principles, and particularly today, our second principle, belief in justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and our fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. Let us hold fast to our principles and to our dreams. One of my favorite quotes, originally from a sermon by the Unitarian minister Parker Palmer in 1853, but paraphrased and made famous by Martin Luther King Jr., is, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." Today, I am holding fast to my dream, a vision of the arc of the moral universe bending toward justice visibly in my lifetime. We will begin with lighting of our chalice by Grace Smith, followed by my lighting of the peace lamp, and then our gathering song.
Good morning, everyone. Now my match breaks. Another world is possible. We say it again and again, even when the proof lies somewhere beyond the horizon, beyond our reach, beyond our imagination. This is our faith, and another world is possible. There are many routes toward liberation, towards freedom, but the abundance of options does not absolve us of responsibility of acting. Another world is possible.
And now I will light the peace lamp. Your response will be, and with all the people of the world. May peace be with us and with all the people of the world. Our gathering song today is hymn number 95, There Is More Love Somewhere, performed by the Jason Shelton Choir of the Church of the Larger Fellowship. Lyrics will appear in the video so you can sing along.
Keep on till I find it.
It's my pleasure this morning to introduce Reverend Aidson Wright Riggins. I know him as Ace, the mayor of Collegeville, but he is also a consummate preacher, as we heard last year in February when we were still in our building. It seems so long ago. I asked Aidson several weeks ago to grace us with his preaching once again, this time by Zoom. At that time, just a few weeks ago, a minister from Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Raphael Warnock, was in a race in a runoff election for a U.S. Senate seat in Georgia. That election was to be held on January 5th, and the balance of power in the U.S. Senate was at stake. We had no idea how that election would turn out, but we knew that the November 3rd election had turned out with the election of Joseph Biden and Kamala Harris, and that the Electoral College would be voting for, the Electoral College vote for president was to be certified by Congress on January 6th. We also knew that MLK Day would be tomorrow, January 18th, and the inauguration of Joseph Biden and Kamala Harris would be this Wednesday, January 20th. So we knew these four events would be consequential bookends for a sermon today on imagination. I had the optimism to imagine that the political fever of our past 4 years and the pandemic fever of the past year might both be breaking by today. I had no idea how high the fever would get on January 6th, but I believe that the fever is breaking. And I am seeing the moral arc of the universe bend once again toward justice.
Langston Hughes was the poet laureate of the African-American community in the 20th century. In 1991, it was the height of the Great Migration, as African-Americans were making their way out of the South, going north and east. It was the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement when he penned these words from his poem, Dreams. Hold fast to dreams. For if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. Hold fast to dreams, for when dreams go, life is a barren field, frozen with snow. In the Hebrew Book of Beginnings, we are introduced to a family. The family was comprised of a husband, Jacob, two wives, Leah and Rachel, and two surrogate servants of those wives, Bilhah and Zilpah. All in all, Jacob had 12 sons between four women, and God knows how many daughters, because the Torah did not keep a census of females back then. Jacob's family was a large and blended one. And from this description alone, we already know that as the curtain opens, there will be drama. For us, the turmoil begins in Genesis 37. The narrator informs us that one of the sons of this clan was named Joseph. And Joseph was distinguished among his brothers because of his father's inexplicable and perhaps extravagant love for him. Joseph wasn't the oldest son. Joseph was not the inheritor designate. Joseph wasn't the baby in the family either. Nor was Joseph the middle child, somebody daddy might have take a special interest in coddling to make sure that he was not psychically squeezed out among the boys squabbling for Jacob's attention. Jacob loved Joseph, although Joseph, like most children, had characteristics that were certainly not particularly lovable about him. Joseph was a dreamer. Going against the grain of his caste-like culture, he dared to dream that his disadvantage and hierarchical position in the family birth order would not determine his destiny. He dared to imagine that he was at least equal to every other sibling in that clan, and with sufficient opportunity, he might in fact exceed them all. Some would argue that Joseph didn't have the good sense to keep his dream to himself. Some would say that his dreams were not dreams at all, but rather they were fantasies from a mind that had no particular grasp on the real constraints and constrictions of his social and political context. Nevertheless, the Book of Beginning tells us that he told his brothers about his dream. The recitation of this dream made his brothers hate him. And there's a particularly poignant line in the narrated script found in Genesis 37:18, where the narrator says, his brothers saw him from a distance. And before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, here comes the dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of these pits. And then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him. And then we shall see what becomes of his dreams. Langston Hughes once raised the question, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat or crust and sugar over? Like syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? Deferred dreams can leave us as dry as dust. Frustrated dreams may fester like an open wound. Stolen dreams can leave society reeking like foul-smelling fish. The demolition of a community's dream can prompt the exasperated dreamers to explode in riotous violence toward the oppressors, or perhaps even worse, implode in self-hatred and nihilism turned inward. As a child, I lived in a multi-generational family in South Central Los Angeles, comprised of my parents, my grandmother, two uncles, and three sisters. Everybody older than 9 years old had recently escaped from down south. The theme of my family's history and every other family that I knew of in my village was one of a people who had spent over 350 years dreaming. Black people had spent generation upon generation upon generation dreaming about getting out of slavery, dreaming about escaping the nightmares of sharecropping, dreaming about no longer suffocating in the stale air of segregation. Black men dreamed of no longer having to step off this curb when a white woman came their way on a sidewalk. Black women dreamed of escaping the degradation and humiliation of not being considered human. Black children dreamed of no longer having to hide and run when white cops came patrolling our neighborhoods. One night, in the middle of the night, I was awakened. That was the night of Mr. Johnson's death. The street was lined with police cars and emergency vehicles, and their lights were flashing. Adults were mulling around outside, gawking behind yellow police tape and ropes. And my parents tried to keep it hush-hush from their four children, but I heard them whispering about it. It was the first time that I'd ever heard the word suicide, and I heard it in hushed tones. I heard Mom and Daddy say something about issues between Mr. and Mrs. Johnson. That's why Mr. Johnson committed suicide, Daddy said. And I'm sure it happened more often than I thought, but I do not recall one other person of my youth taking his own life in my neighborhood back in the day. Yet, I often felt that the shadow of death was lurking in my community, seeking to devour us. Something or someone was trying to steal our souls, snatch our joy, keep us stuck in the dark, overcast skies of yesterday with no hope of sunshine tomorrow. I distinctly remember the words that were used to describe the demise of Mr. Johnson, but yet they were something more than suicide. I could not escape the fear that the fabric of my community's existence was extremely fragile, and there was something that was laying in wait to rip it to shreds. Even as a child, I recall wrestling with that something, and I suspected it was more multidimensional and more socially complex than suicide, but I did not yet have words for it. What do you call it, I wondered, when one social group or one racial group causes loss of life or excruciating suffering and the annihilation of meaning or purpose on another social group? What do you call it, I wondered, when one people you consider part of the human family play the role of Reuben and Simeon and Levi and Judah and conspire against you, their brother, against you, their sister, throwing you into the pit and then declaring, there goes the dreamer. Let us see what happens to that dream. It wasn't until years later that I learned that there were indeed words for what I was experiencing in that ghettoized, apartheid, South Central Los Angeles community. Raphael Lemkin called it genocide, the intentional act to destroy people in whole or apart. Others called it fratricide, the killing of one's brother or one's sister. My anguish was palpable as the harsh realities of Black life seeped into my subconscious. Black men dying of strokes and heart attacks before they were 50 years old. Black women suffering from obesity and diabetes. Old folks being unable to retire because there was no such thing as a pension or a social security check for them. Children never having seen a dentist. Textbooks second, third, and fourth hand discarded by white schools from across town. Food deserts in our neighborhoods, but liquor stores dotting every single corner. Toxic waste dumps are serving as the gateways to our housing development. Here comes the dreamer. Let us slay them and see what becomes of their dreams. Nevertheless, My anguish and anger was tempered by amazement. For as long as I can remember, I've been amazed by the capacity of Black people to keep on going, keep on dreaming. Seldom did I see the Josephs and the Josephinas crumble under the crucible of disdain and denial. They kept on dreaming even when their lives hovered precipitously over the yawning pit. Looking back on the history of my people, I wondered what motivated my forefathers to keep breathing air tainted with the blood of lynched friends and neighbors as they picked cotton from sunup to sundown. I wondered what my foremothers thought about, dreamed about, as they tried to sleep next to my forefathers in the same bed at night, never knowing when at any moment she might be called to the big house to warm the bed of a man who legally owned her. I wondered what it was about Black folks that would keep thousands of them off the buses in Montgomery, Alabama, when their feet were tired of walking. Or stationary in Nashville, Tennessee, at lunch counters while around about them people spat upon them and cursed them. I wondered. I wondered what kept people keeping on when churches were bombed, when Tulsa was terrorized, when education was denied, when jobs were not forthcoming, when votes were stolen, when Medgar and Malcolm and Martin were gunned down. No, few of my forebears ever sang the words of the rapper Grandmaster Flash when he said, "Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying to keep my head. It's like a jungle sometimes and makes me wonder how I keep from going under." But I did hear them loudly sing the words of Langston Hughes. Hold fast to dreams. For if dreams die, life is a broken winged bird that cannot fly. Hold fast to dreams. For when dreams go, life is a barren field frozen with snow. Black America, how is it that you have not gone insane? How is it that you have not gone under? How is it that you refuse to give up on America? Joseph and Josephina, what might you offer to your sisters and brothers of a lighter hue who wonder but may not yet have the nerve to ask, what makes you so strong? But at the risk of sounding too spiritual, too religious, too simplistic, or perhaps too Christian this morning, I want to share with you one core belief that has sustained Black Americans in the United States for the last 400 years. But not only in America, but in Africa for millennia. And the core belief that I want to share with you this morning is simply one of 10 core beliefs that comprise the corpus of what I call soul folk theology. I want to share this core belief because I believe so many of us hang in the crucible or at the crossroads of the crucible where we might give up on ourselves and our future. Formulated and adapted in the language of Unitarian minister Tom Shahade, it is simply this. There is a power at work in the universe. It works through human hands, but it was not made with human hands. It is the creative, sustaining, and transforming power, and that we can trust it, that very power, with our lives. This power will sustain us, and whenever we take a stand on the side of love and justice, it will sustain us. Trust in that power, for we are together held by that power. Dare to hold fast to dreams, or dare to imagine that you're in the grip of that power, because it will change us and change our world. Now, academicians would philosophically articulate this as the need to have a philosophical, a positive worldview. Theologians might express it as the providence of God. But Big Mama would simply say, boy, don't you fret about it. Don't you know that God is in charge? Big Mama, for me, is that repository and conduit of the richness of African and African-American spiritual tradition. Big Mama is the one that is attuned to the oral and the oral tradition that is much more powerful than the linear or literal word. She is the profound expositor and expressor of stories and narratives that embraced a multicultural theological fluency that spanned the intercontinental trade, slave trade, the peculiar institution, and Jim Crow segregation. It was no surprise to me that Big Mama would quote Apostle Paul when he said, for we know that God works in everything for the good of those who love God and are called according to God's plan. She would quote that because the Baptist preacher that she listened to every week would quote that as a showstopper. But Big Mama had more than even that. She had the cultural memory to reach all the way back to the old fables and the old stories and the old proverbs that had been handed down to her from her mama and her mama's mama. And she would say things like the Yoruba proverb, it's God who drives away the flies from the cow that has no tail. Or she'd quote things like from the Ashanti, when the Ashanti would say, it is the supreme being who pounds the pufu for the one who has no arms. Or she would say things like the ganja we used to say, God arranges it so that the leper's sandals breaks when he comes under the camel foot bush, for God will not allow the leper to be shoeless. Please know that Big Mama was not naive in her theological, spiritual, or philosophical pronouncements. She knew that the loving, transformative power of the universe does not operate in a vacuum. She knew that the existence of evil was and is real for her and for her children. So as she strummed her fingers on our Formica kitchen table, she would say things like this: the drum of slander is real, but God will not allow it to make a sound in our village. Long before I heard Martin Luther King say the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice, Big Mama was busy vaccinating us and the whole generation of survivors and activists with the anti-racist, anti-oppressive, anti-virus that God has guaranteed that our lives matter and will always be worth living. It was this fundamental core belief that motivated my own mother to give me a ring at age 12 years old, one of my most cherished possessions and gifts, inscribed with the words, "This too shall pass." For when round about me barked the mad and hungry dogs of discrimination and nullification, I would look at those powerful words of providence and dare to dream what eyes had not yet seen, nor what ears had not yet heard, that those who endure to the end shall win. Those words inspired me and us to keep on keeping on. How else could John Lewis march across the James Pettus Bridge while surrounded by a sea of state troopers? How else could Shirley Chisholm dare to become the first black person seeking the presidential election from one of the major political parties in 1991, competing against George Wallace, the fierce face of Southern segregation? I'm convinced that the secret sauce of sustenance in progressive movements is a spirituality that is undergirded in this core belief in providence. Some of us are still undergirded by the prayers we heard Big Mama pray, or those old deacons pray in the Black Baptist churches of my youth. These poor people still under the humiliating thumb of Mr. Charlie and Miss Ann Monday through Friday would get dressed on their Sunday best on Sunday morning, make it to the church house and fall on their knees and pray words like these, saying, Lord, we thank you for waking us up this morning, touching us with the finger of your love. We thank you for the fact that our beds were not our cooling board, and that we were clothed in our right minds, and that we were able to pick and choose our own praying guard. I did not know it at the time, but Big Mama and those old deacons were feeding us and their descendants secret sauce and giving us nuggets of emancipation. You see, the fact that we would show up on Sunday morning and give thanks was testament to their belief that life always had enough left to make it worth living. Personal and collective suicide was not an option, nor was murder. In fact, these old saints would add to this Sunday morning prayer and thank God for giving us a reasonable portion of health and strength. Now, I never quite knew what a reasonable portion was, but I came to understand that it was enough. Daddy King, Martin Luther King Jr.'s father. Daddy King had lost two sons, and in addition to that, later lost his wife, Alberta King, as she sat at the organ of Ebenezer Baptist Church. Yet, he was able to thank God for what he called the leavings, what's left. In order to face tomorrow, we need to believe, we need to hold fast to dreams, if you will, that God will leave us enough for which to face tomorrow. If I had time, I'd tell you more about how black folks have always made it with what's left. What's left, the intestines of a pig. What's left, the foot of a chicken. Somebody else's piece of old car, a sofa in the garage, the after-hours part-time job. No, it's never been easy, but if you focus on what's left rather than what you don't have, or thinking about it as simply somebody else's leftovers, you can make a transformative difference in your life and continue in the fight for justice and peace. In addition to leavings, Big Mama's core belief in folk theology reminds us that God sets limits. God sets limits. That's what Preston was talking about earlier. Stating that we were able to choose our own praying ground was their way of saying that the transformative loving presence in the universe places ultimate limits on the impact of evil. You see, in 1964, I didn't think it could get any worse. James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner were down there in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and they lost their lives trying to register poor black folks to vote. Not only with their valiant efforts to register folks to vote not make a substantial difference for election for decades to come, these black and Jewish men were murdered in the process. They too had heard the words, "Here come the dreamers. Let us slay them and see what becomes of their dreams." Well, I'll tell you what becomes of their dreams. In a day or two, a 33-year-old Jew by the name of John Osloff and a black Baptist preacher by the name of Raphael Warnock will be sworn in as United States senators in the deep red southern state of Georgia. Big Mama would say that the transformative loving power of the universe may not come when you want it, but that power does come on time. So hold fast to your dream. Finally, this core belief reminds us how important mental and emotional balance is in our lives. Big Mama said that we are awakened every day, touched by the loving finger of God and clothed in our right minds. What if you and I held fast to the dream that each and every one of us is touched by the finger of God's love? What a difference it would make in how we treated each other if we really believed that we were brothers and sisters and had no right to throw any person into the pit. What if we really believed that? We would realize that no person deserves the pit as their ultimate destiny. If we dare to believe that, we would cease fighting about who has the coat of many colors and begin to make sure that all of God's children had at least one coat and that we all saw each other's as siblings and children of God. Knowing that we are touched by the finger of God's love provides us with the emotional and mental reserves to keep on keeping on anyhow. So we recall how the story of Joseph began. His brothers despised him. They saw him and said, "Here comes that dreamer. Let us slay him and see what becomes of his dreams." But there's the rest of the story. Joseph was thrown into the pit, forsaken to be forgotten, but he kept dreaming. Hold fast to dreams, Joe, for if dreams die, life is like a broken winged bird that cannot fly. But then he was rescued only to be sold into slavery, but he kept on dreaming. Hold fast to dreams, Joe, for when dreams go, life is a barren field frozen with snow. He was pulled up from bondage and got himself an entry-level position in King Potiphar's palace. Hold fast to dreams, Joe. But that job didn't last long because the king's wife made a move on him and he refused her proposition. And poor Joe, damned if he did and damned if he didn't. But hold fast to dreams, Joe. I'm going to let you go home and read the rest of the narrative. But let me skip to the end of the story. Finally, after slavery, after sharecropping, after Jim Crow, after assassination, after many dangers, toils, and snares, the tables finally turned. And Joseph not only had a dream, he became the dream. The arc of the universe does bend. And those who sit high shall be brought low. And those whose lives are a nightmare shall have the dream of justice fulfilled. For those who hold fast to dreams, the day of judgment will not be a day of wrath, where those who have been victimized will seek revenge on their tormentors, but rather it will be a day of truth and reconciliation and reparation and repentance. And that will be the day in which justice reigns. Listen to how this story is wrapped up. Fearing Joseph's anger, retribution, and vengefulness, these brothers, the narrator says, Joseph saw them, and Joseph wept when his brothers spoke to him. For they came then saying, let us be your slaves. And his brothers wept, and they fell down before him and says, let us be your slaves. But Joseph said, don't be afraid. I am not in the place of God. Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people, as God is doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and for your little ones. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or perhaps explode? Perhaps. And certainly so for those who do not hold fast to the dream that we are all God's children and history is in the hands of a purposive God, and nothing, absolutely nothing, can thwart God's purposes for those who live according to God's purposes. My brothers and sisters, hold fast to dreams. For if dreams die, life is like a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. Hold fast to dreams, for if dreams go, life is like a barren field covered with snow. Amen and amen.
And now, Mike, I guess, do you want to lead us in matters of the heart and explain what we're doing after the musical meditation, the musical interlude?
Sure. Yes. We'll have just a short musical interlude here to give people a chance to gather their thoughts on both the things that have raised them up over the past week or the things that have brought them down, or any particular thoughts or reflections on the wise words of Reverend Wright Riggins today. And at the end of the Matters of the Heart musical interlude, I will go through the process of explaining how we can share. This should be old hat to most of us, but we'll still go over it. And then we will begin our time of sharing. Thank you.
And now we will extinguish our chalice. We extinguish the flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, the fire of commitment, nor the dreams to which we hold fast. All of these we carry in our hearts until we gather again.
Our closing song today is hymn number 121, We'll Build a Land. The words will come up on the screen along with video here in just a moment.
We're just